This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Joining us now is CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. And Jill, there's something wrong with my stopwatch because every time I time the market bottom, there seems to be a new market bottom. So what gives?
Well, you're not alone. I think that many have tried to time the market and have failed. And what we now know is that with really dozens and dozens of years of experience that no one can time the market. No one knows when to get in and when to get out. And the research really does back it up. So we've got this big research that comes out every year about, you know, which managers beat the stock market index or the bond market index against which they're measured. And what we find out time and time again is that very few can beat the index. And the weird thing is that even if one does manage to beat the index, it's a different in manager year from year. So you might say, oh, I'm going to buy, this guy, Frank, he's an amazing manager. He beat last year. And then you find out, well, he doesn't beat for another 17 years after that. So what's your best bet? How about you just pick low-cost index funds, you spread your risk out, you diversify. Doesn't work every year, doesn't work in every minute, but over the long term, it really does work and keeps you in sort of in sync with your generalized financial game plan.
But you have talked in the past about the concept of capitulation, where it finally gets to a point where the people who haven't got the stomach for it just throw in the towel and take their losses. Have we reached that yet?
I don't know. See, that's the other thing. Who knows? And I say that sort of with a joking way, but it's sort of almost weirdly comforting to me to understand that because nobody knows, I can stop talking about it and I can stop thinking about it as an individual investor. You know, that if there is someone saying like, oh, now's the time to get in. No, nobody knows that. But here's what people do know. If you stick to your game plan over the long term, you're probably going to be okay. And the problem with timing the market is that you find that when we look back, if you figure out like, oh, I was so smart, I missed this big down day, you very rarely know when to get back in. And so the problem with market timing is that when you miss the big down days, you also may miss the big up days. So if you look back for the past 30 years and you miss the 15 best single days of performance, the return on your S&P 500 goes from almost 11% annualized to 7% annualized.
Yikes.
And if you miss 25 days over a 30 time horizon, I'm talking 1990 to 2021, you miss the 25 best days, you basically get your performance cut in half from about 11% to a little more than 5.5%. That's just a bad bunch of data that shows very clearly, hey, you're not going to time the market.
Well, can we at least say then that whatever the Fed is doing to control inflation, it must be working because we all feel so miserable?
That's good. Well, I mean, listen, it's funny how we feel miserable, but we don't act like it. In other words, a lot of people are still spending money. So what does that tell me? It tells me that maybe we actually do have a lot of people who still have that extra savings from the pandemic. They still have that. We also have a job market that's pretty solid. We're going to get a jobs report out on Friday. It's probably going to show 250,000 jobs created during the month. That's a lot of jobs to be created for people feeling so lousy. So if you really feel lousy, a couple things to think about are, number one, if you're worried about your investments, remember, you're in it for the long term. Even if you're already retired, your retirement's probably going to be 20 or 30 years. So try to take a deep breath. Of course, if you need cash within the next 12 months, maybe you got to pay a tuition bill. Maybe you're doing a home improvement. That money should never have been at risk. Get it out of the markets. And also, take control of the things you can control. You know what you can control? You can control your taxes. You can control how much you're paying for investments. And if you can find some free money, maybe you want to fire your manager and go to an automatic one. Maybe you want to actually pay an index fund fee of like 0.03% rather than 1% for a managed fund in your retirement account. If you can find some free money, this is a good time to do it. Finally, you know, I talked about this last time. I'm just talking about the job market. Just be careful not to jump around and take a job just for money, because if the economy does roll over in the next 12 months, sometimes the last person in is the first one out.
Right. Gas prices, I noticed they took a jump over the last week. Is that the hurricane?
Probably. What we fear most about gas prices is not really what we should fear in the inflation data, you know, because I think oil and gas, those things sort of reset at normal levels. Same thing with the food index after, you know, we'll get that settled down. I'm much more focused on everything else like shelter. You know, shelter, the cost of putting a roof over your head is usually the highest the biggest portion of your household budget. So we are starting to see a little bit of early data showing that maybe we've peaked out in the increases in rental prices. So I'm hopeful for that.
One thing I'm curious about, having nothing to do with us, I don't think, is that in the UK, where the new prime minister decided to cut the income tax rate for high earners, which had been at 45%, everybody condemned it. It apparently threw the economy into turmoil. And there was even some concern it would have a backlash here, which I don't get that. Can you explain why that was such a big deal?
Well, I mean, it's sort of the big deal. The big picture big deal is that, that British exchequer, which is like our Treasury Secretary, announced a plan that kind of everyone agrees doesn't work, which is you cut the taxes of the top people and it actually filters down to the little people.
You mean trickle down?
Does not trickle down. Yeah. Supply side doesn't work. But also, they announced this big plan with no actual even semblance of an idea of how they're going to pay for it, which actually meant that the British government would have to go out and borrow money to pay for tax cuts for the rich. Not that the U.S. government hasn't done that. We just haven't done it at a time where we've come off of a pandemic and a war in Ukraine. For big U.S. companies, I said this last week, if you are Boeing, you don't want a strong dollar. That is not good for you because that makes that Airbus competitor look a lot more compelling in the foreign market.
Okay, so given that cutting taxes on the rich, or the attempt to cut taxes on the rich in Britain, caused such chaos over there, does that mean the same thing for us? Because there are calls here to also fix inflation by cutting taxes on Americans.
Yeah, not going to happen. Listen, anything that puts more money in the pockets of Americans, weirdly, actually is inflationary, right? Just think of that. If you have more money, you can afford to buy more stuff. Now, I know it's counterintuitive. I think that people at the bottom who need help paying their heating bills for the winter, yeah, that's one thing. But just putting money in the hands of someone who already has a job, has savings, and is just going to spend money is not a really good idea. It's not a game plan for cutting inflation. Inflation has two issues: the demand side and the supply side. We cannot do anything about the supply side except hope that the supply chains get loosened, and there's signs they're already loosening, and that needs to get fixed. But the demand side is what the Fed is really focused on. They want to make it more expensive to do everything.
CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thank you, Jill.
Thank you.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Let's talk about Alzheimer's and alcohol. There's some new research on this topic. Time to page the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. So I wasn't aware that alcohol could have any sort of beneficial effect on Alzheimer's disease, but apparently there's a new statistical study on that.
Yeah, that's right. There was a study that was published last month in Addiction, which is a journal obviously focusing on that topic. They looked at the relationship between alcohol use and dementia in adults who are over 60 years of age, where they looked at studies that had already been published, so there was a meta-analysis component to it. And then they also looked at a prospective individual participant data from 15 additional studies. What they found ultimately was that there are actually some benefits to consuming alcohol, that for people in their midlife, if they consume low to moderate amounts of alcohol, there's actually a protective effect towards developing dementia. Whereas consumption of high amounts of alcohol increased your risk of developing dementia, but teetotaling, not consuming any alcohol at all, also increased your risk of dementia. So it's what's called a U-shaped relationship if you plot the risk of dementia versus alcohol consumption.
That was the most surprising part to me, that for people who decided, as you say, not to drink any alcohol, probably thinking it would keep them healthier, at least in the case when it comes to Alzheimer's, statistically, that wasn't the case. How do we know that the alcohol, though, was the reason? Couldn't it be something else that these people have in common with or other healthy behaviors that the moderate drinkers pursue that might actually be responsible for the protective effect?
Right. So when they do these types of studies, they try to look at all the potential factors and then do statistical analyses in such a way that they can look at one particular factor. So they can look at the risk of alcohol or the risk of high blood pressure or the risk of diabetes or whatnot. So it's a complex methodology of statistics. But when they do that, they can, for the most part, isolate out the risk factor that they're looking for. And in this particular instance, they were looking for alcohol. Like I said, they collected data from 15 prospective epidemiological cohort studies that were conducted across six different continents. Mm-hmm. So this wasn't
a huge number of people.
There was nearly 25,000 people in the study with a mean age of nearly 72 years of age. 54% were concurrent drinkers. And what was interesting about that group, if you're already in your older years, so you're already, say, 70 or older, and you're consuming alcohol, that there was no relationship between consuming alcohol and the development of dementia. So it's really in those midlife years where the risk of developing dementia from either drinking too much alcohol or drinking too little alcohol occurs. And if you consume small to moderate amounts, it's protective.
So how do we use this information? It sounds like for people who are listening and they're in their 20s and 30s and deciding, okay, should I be teetotal or should I be a moderate drinker in my middle years? This study would indicate drink at least a little bit of alcohol.
Right. It does. And if you're worried about dementia, that's not to say that there aren't other potential risks to consuming alcohol, but that's not the purpose of this particular study. And in this study, they were able to condense it down to amount of pure ethanol. So they came up with a number which was 40 grams of pure ethanol a day. One 12-ounce beer or one 5-ounce glass of wine or one 1.5-ounce shot of a distilled liquor contains about 14 grams of alcohol. So we can triple that and we would be at 42 grams, which is close enough. So you're talking about 4.5 ounces of liquor, 15 ounces of wine, or three beers in a day. So, you know, it's not an insignificant amount of alcohol, but clearly for most people, it's not an amount that's going to cause them to be, you know, lose control and get intoxicated.
So are we going to see beer commercials that saying, and may help prevent brain deterioration when you get older?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you bring that up. I mean, I'm not sure that's where you're going to see it. But, you know, I mean, it's an interesting thing to note, right? Because there's always been a debate about the risks and benefits of consuming alcohol. And for the longest time, the wine industry pushed wine by talking about the health benefits of wine. And in fact, they commissioned a lot of scientific studies to be done around the world to be able to actually show that there were health benefits to consuming wine. But they were largely focusing on the antioxidant benefits of wine, so the resveratrol and whatnot that's found within the wine. But this is actually looking specifically at the ethanol component. Look, I always take sort of the position when we talk about everything in moderation, because I think that generally is the best approach and it's the least likely to get you into any trouble. What this can do is take sort of the mental burden off of people who do consume moderate amounts of alcohol and are worried about the long-term risks. And if they really are sticking to, you know, a glass of wine or two a day or, you know, a few a week or something like that, that they really don't have to worry that there are some potential health benefits to it. And it's been shown repeatedly in multiple studies. And in this case, an international multi-continent study with 25,000 people. So I think it's real.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Monday morning, time for Hannah Scott to join us with today's edition of Crime and Punishment. And this morning we have an arsonist, we have a dangerous driver who nearly took out a family, we have an update on the open-air drug market along 3rd Avenue. So, Hannah, lay this out for us.
Good morning, Dave. So case number one involves an encampment fire and a guy named Eddie Sledge.
Last December, there was a tent fire about a block off Rainier Avenue South near Rainier Playfield. There were two people inside, a man and a woman. And when Seattle police went to investigate, there was a witness who said that he saw a guy going to the gas station nearby and poured gas on this tent before he lit it on fire. And one of the victims came out and said, "What are you doing?" This is the case that King County prosecutors rush filed. We asked for the defendant here to be held on $100,000 because we argued that he's a danger. And this isn't somebody who went to the encampment to target the folks there. The victims and the defendant were known to each other before this happened. But whatever the dispute was, this is not the way to handle it.
Casey McNerthney with the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office says they were able to quickly file charges here and argued for that $100,000 bail.
Seattle police did really good work to get us this case with the evidence that we needed to file it immediately. And faced with that evidence, the defendant pleaded guilty, and he was ultimately convicted of a felony arson charge and said that he maliciously set that tent on fire. He's got a history of violence, which King County prosecutors showed to the judge with our high bail request. You know, his conviction history includes multiple assault cases and criminal trespass, harassment, interfering with domestic violence reporting. However, most of his cases weren't referred to King County prosecutors, and the majority of his convictions are misdemeanors. And that matters because in Washington State, if you're convicted of misdemeanors, those don't count towards your offender score, which influences how long you stay in prison for a new offense.
So when it came to sentencing Friday?
What happened here with this felony arson conviction is that his range, even though he's got multiple misdemeanor convictions, his range was 12 to 14 months. The defendant was sentenced to 12 months on Friday and also 18 months in community custody with the Department of Corrections, and also had to submit his DNA to a criminal database that checks for matches in other criminal cases. An important thing to note here is that victims of crimes deserve justice regardless of where they live, and people who commit felony crimes can expect charges whenever we can prove those cases, regardless of where they happen in King County.
And next up, the case of Travis Swan.
Sunday night in September 2020, calls started coming in to 911 describing an erratic car that was speeding on 405. And what 911 callers said was that this car was drifting across lanes and then suddenly exited the highway. And there was a red light there, but this Acura didn't stop and plowed into the back of a Tesla. It was a young couple in their 20s with their 3-year-old daughter in the back. The 3-year-old was in a car seat, but still the impact was so intense that the child got a concussion when she was flung up to the ceiling of this car, and her dad got a concussion too. The mom in this case suffered a really serious compound arm and shoulder fracture that required emergency surgery.
Now, this case was handled by prosecutor Amy Friedheim, who, along with a handful of advocates, has been arguing for tougher DUI laws in the states for years. And on this one, she wanted the max.
The dad got out and chased after this guy because the driver who hit them tried to run and hide in some bushes. Some witnesses also chased him, too. And when cops showed up, it turns out this guy had a gun under his seat, which this is all around a bad combo. He had multiple felony convictions out of Pierce County, including 3 convictions for ID theft and 2 for attempted robbery. So this is a guy who had a high offender score going into his sentencing here. He was convicted of vehicular assault, felony hit and run, and unlawful gun possession.
Wow. And he was sentenced to more than 5 years on Friday. Our final case involves a guy named Caleb Bell.
The standard range, it was between 51 and at least 60 months. Amy, in this case, argued for 70 months, nearly 6 years. And on Friday, a judge sentenced him to that 70 months and also required the defendant to get evaluations for substance abuse and alcohol.
So that is back on the driver. I'll tell you the case of Caleb Bell. Caleb Bell, this is a very scary case. So this happened on New Year's Day of this year at a QFC right at the Shoreline North Seattle border. And basically, a guy comes in. He's got something slinged over his shoulder that the clerk thinks is probably like a rifle of some sort. He asked the clerk for a pack of cigarettes. The clerk says, yeah, you can have them if you pay for them. And the guy took offense to that and then demanded money. He pointed what was a rifle at this guy and tried to rob him, take cigarettes, put this thing right in the guy's face. It was an AK-47. Nice. Eventually, the guy ran off and he came. The cops found him later after 911 was called. That was a loaded AK-47 that ended up having a round in the chamber that he had pointed at this poor clerk. And this guy has a very, very long felony history. He had, I think, harassment. He had trespass. He had had interfering with domestic violence reporting, a lot of different charges on his history, which made the range a little bit higher under the state sentencing guidelines. But they also went for a firearms enhancement here, which added significant years, actually, to the sentence. In the end, on Friday, he was sentenced. I think prosecutors asked for 5.5 years. The judge didn't go quite that far, but gave him 5.25 years. But they argued, you know, this guy is absolutely a danger to society, right?
Yeah.
Walking around with an AK-47.
Right. All right, what's next?
So what's next? We've got the just an update. This isn't from the sentencings. This is an update on what's going on 3rd Avenue, which is improving slightly. Some of the businesses there are saying that they're seeing a little bit of improvement out on the street. And it was a big deal for open-air drug dealing, right, for such a long time. But Casey says prosecutors have been very active with drug dealing, felony drug dealing charges all year, not just along 3rd, but specifically along 3rd. They have filed 35 felony drug dealing cases since the start of 2022. That's involving 33 different people, and that's all at 3rd and Pike. So they've really been targeting, and you've got, of course, SPD doing emphasis patrols there, which is making a difference. But they're really collaborating as part of that effort we talked about early in the year.
Good.
So quick breakdown, though. Do you have a question? Go ahead.
No, I was just saying good. I read about that in the paper, and even the local residents were complimenting the police on the difference that they've made. So anytime you see a detectable difference like that, I think it's a great thing.
And it is a great thing. We just need enough cops to do it all over the city, and we'll be in good shape. Of the 35 drug dealing charges, though, 24 of these involve fentanyl, which I don't think is a huge surprise to anybody. It's such the big, dangerous drug right now, but it's just moving everywhere. 6 involved meth, 4 involved crack, and then just one case involving heroin. So you probably saw the Seattle Times story where they're talking about fentanyl has replaced the black tar heroin that used to be. The other scary part of that, though, is that of those 35 drug dealing charges against people on specifically 3rd and Pike, 10 also involved a gun charge. So people walking around with loaded weapons, too.
Car News Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Baird. It's about what a consistent level of support can do for kids. Here's Steve Hartman.
Fire! Sequence fire!
We came to Antioch Community High School near Chicago to meet the record holder, the undisputed champion of showing up. 91-year-old superfan Steve Young hasn't missed a single Antioch football game since 1946. Not that there haven't been close calls, like the summer he got in a traffic accident in a thunderstorm.
I had 11 broken bones, punctured left lung, and while I was laying on a stretcher, I got hit by lightning, knocked me off the stretcher.
Wait. You got hit by lightning while you're on the stretcher?
On the stretcher. They got me in the hospital, and the one doctor said, he's not going to make it. And I said, you guys don't know what you're talking about. I said, I've got a game to go to.
And sure enough, a few weeks later, he was at the season opener.
But it's not just football. Steve has also been to virtually every basketball game, softball game, and volleyball match. He goes to tennis matches, golf matches, and even bowling tournaments. He is omnipresent at more than 20 sports, plus plays and concerts.
We talked to students and former students across 3 generations.
He was at our games, no matter what.
Rain or shine.
Home or away.
Every single one. He's always there.
For some athletes, it's maybe the only person that they have at the game. So,
Steve says that's true. Kids have told him so.
I've had kids come up and say, my parents never show up for anything.
What's that like to hear?
It kind of hits home.
And it's a big reason why he doesn't. Recently, as a thank you for his 76 years of love and support, the school made Steve Grand Marshal of the Homecoming Parade and honored him at a game where all that cheering he'd done for others finally echoed back. A resounding message that sometimes the most important thing you can do for a child is just be there, no matter what.
Somehow or some way I'd make it.
You know, you're not going to live forever. You're going to miss a game.
Who says?
I stand corrected. Steve Hartman, on the road in Antioch, Illinois.
7:48, Seattle's Morning News. And now from Generous LeChaux, here is G. Scott.
Hey.
Dancing, fireworks. Maybe they partied too hard based on what I saw in yesterday's game. But, yeah, the skipper was the happiest guy in town. So now we want more. We don't know who they're going to play in the playoffs yet.
No, not yet. We know the playoffs start on Friday, I believe. And, man, I just don't know what else I can say about what this has done to this city. For the first time in a long time. Not only, I mean, occasionally, you guys, you know, you see someone wearing their Mariners t-shirts or Mariners hats. But now, over the weekend, I actually saw people talking about the Mariners, right? Yeah. Like, it is the biggest discussion. Right, yeah. It is safe in 21 years. And I think that... I think I thought I knew how big it was, but I don't really think I did, because it's really cool seeing how the young kids are talking about this. They've never known what it was like for the Mariners to be in the playoffs. Some of you guys as children, maybe they were a certain age, and now that, I mean, Colleen, you didn't even have kids.
No, well, I didn't.
What was you doing in 2001?
I was a kid in 2001. Yeah. I was still in high school.
See what I'm saying?
And I lived through the best of the Mariners, the 95 season in 2001. That was my childhood. So it's nice to see, and I think you saw a lot of the millennials and the Gen Xers. They were openly sobbing,
right,
wailing in the stands, that release of built-up fandom and letdown year after year after year. It was incredible to see
how
emotional it was.
Somebody asked me this weekend, like, okay, but if the Mariners don't do well in the playoffs, isn't it a messed up season? What?
No.
No. It reminds me of the first time you get your first apartment. You don't have it fully furnished. You got a mattress on the floor. You got your TV on the floor. And you riding.
Yeah.
That's how I used to do this. Who, Colleen, have you ever had a mattress on the floor?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Most of my furniture in college came from the dumpster in Bellevue of my apartment complex. You know the nice things people get rid of in Bellevue?
Right. And by the way, whose idea was, and why did we all think this was a phenomenal idea? We all went and got it. We thought it was the greatest idea in the world. And we look back and we're like, man, and our back is like, what were you thinking? The futon.
The futon.
Who
I slept on a futon,
that was
too.
A good idea.
And a lumpy futon mattress. So speaking of winners, the Seahawks also pulled it off. I listened to the first quarter of the game on the radio, and it was like touchdown after touchdown, right? And I was like, oh, they got this. And I turned it off because I had some business. And then I tuned back in, and 48-45, they were going off on each other.
They were. It was a shootout at the OK Corral, if you will. There was a lot of points scored. You're not usually used to those kind of games. It is the second highest point total in Seahawks history as far as a game. Number one, let me just say this, they got the win. Number two, they're now 2-2. They have the same record as the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, okay? So they are on pace to maybe do some things. It is hard to win in the National Football League. Geno Smith is playing really well. He's got the highest quarterback percentage, passing percentage in the NFL at 77%.
What?
Yeah!
In the NFL?
Yeah, regular season.
Whoa!
77% completions.
Yikes. Where has he been all our lives?
He's been backed up.
Writing you back.
You know, the thing about Geno Smith and what's happening for him, I am super happy. I think Seahawks fans are super happy. But it goes to show you that oftentimes, even in corporate America and in real life, we seem to value people that have a higher paycheck than those that don't. So we look at Geno Smith, who's only going to make $3 million this year. I know that's a lot still. But compared to other quarterbacks that'll make $40 million this year, and you just assume, oh, he's not good. Oh, he hasn't been a starter in 8 years. So that should be a lesson to everyone. Just because life hasn't been going well, just because you faced some adversity, doesn't mean you can't get your turn. And Geno Smith is having that. And I did have good news and bad news, but I just don't want to talk about the bad news about the Seahawks.
All right.
The bad news is man, they can't allow 45 points to be scored on them against the Detroit defense, against the Detroit Lions, who had a lot of their offensive starters out of the game. I mean, I don't care. I know it's a win. I'm not trying to rain on the parade. But I know Pete Carroll is losing his mind having 45 points scored on them. So that part, they're going to have to get dressed up.
And the Broncos lost. So there's that.
I'm just saying.
Dave.
Poor Russell. I love that. Dave. No, bitter Dave is a good, it's a good look. Encouraging.
Just an observation.
Dave, are you petty, fam?
No, I'm not petty. No, I just did tune in to see what was going on with the Broncos game.
Why'd you do that?
And I saw that they
Why'd you tune into the Broncos? To see?
I love Denver.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And it seems to me that every year your smartphone gets closer and closer to a Star Trek tricorder that can pretty much diagnose anything that's wrong with you. And Jason Hoffman is one of the people who is working on apps that will bring that about. Jason is a doctoral student at the University of Washington, the Paul G. Allen School of Computer Science and Engineering. And so tell me about the app that you've developed here.
Sure. Yeah, it's really a research project at this stage. But the goal is to be able to detect what's called your blood oxygen saturation or SpO2 level. You may have heard of this in the context of COVID, but it's also a major concern for asthma and COPD patients.
It's that clip they put on your finger when you're in the hospital, right?
Exactly. Yeah. In the doctor's office, they'll measure it with a purpose-built device, like a clip around your finger. And we tried to do it with a smartphone application.
So in other words, no attachment necessary.
Right.
Just your smartphone as it is.
Yep, that's the goal.
So how do you pull that off?
So actually your smartphone has a lot of fancy sensors in it that are used for general purpose things like taking pictures or recording things on, for a phone call or uploading videos, things like that. And those sensors can actually be repurposed for measuring things like your physiology and things inside your body.
How did you start testing this theory that you thought, well, the camera and the flash of the camera might be able to give us some clues?
I'm really lucky to be able to work with a great team in my lab. And so actually this project was started by a grad student several years ahead of me. He had done a lot of work with measuring blood using the smartphone camera. And he and my advisor, Shwetik Patel, this grad student was Edward Wong, who's now a professor at UCSD. They kind of came up with the concept, and I started in grad school right before the pandemic. So once the pandemic hit and we realized pulse oximetry was really important, we really put that idea into action.
How did you test it out and discover this actually works?
Yeah, so it was a few steps. One is we looked at the research that was in the field before us. That's kind of what scientists do, is read papers. There were a few groups, one at SMU in Texas, who had tried this before, and they showed that it worked to a certain extent. So we were aware that it could potentially be a good solution, which is using the camera to put it against your finger and try to measure the similar signals that pulse oximeter does. But we really wanted to take it to the next level, which is they had kind of limited themselves with their procedure to a certain range of SpO2 levels. So kind of mostly in the healthy range, they were able to show that it was working. And really, when you have a medical device, you want to know that it works when you're healthy, but also when you're sick. If it only works when you're healthy, then it's never going to be able to tell you if something's wrong. And so we then looked into research, or I guess Edward did back in the day, looked into how these pulse oximeters are validated. How do you actually check if one's working? And there's procedure that's standard for every finger clip pulse oximeter, which is to basically artificially lower someone's SpO2 level from the healthy level in the 90, 95 range, all the way down to 70%. We had subjects, you can make in
a
face.
Hold your breath? I mean, how do you do that? That's dangerous.
So actually, that's a good guess. People in previous studies had used breath holding, but you can't actually make yourself that uncomfortable without, like, by choice. People end up needing to breathe at a certain point. They were only able to get down to that healthy range, like 90. They were able to get a few validation points at 85% SpO2. But this procedure that we used, and is commonly used to validate pulse oximeters, you actually have someone sit in a hospital room and they breathe in a controlled mixture of oxygen and nitrogen over a slow period of time, and their body actually adjusts to it. So it feels a little bit more comfortable and they're able to survive. And we have someone sitting there in case anything goes wrong. You know, they can end the study at any time. But people were able to get their SpO2 all the way down to 70%. And wow. So validating across that whole range of 70 to 100 is really important, because then if someone actually has a medical problem, they might be down at 85 or 80. And we validated that our app, you know, confidently can say if someone's pretty low.
Okay, so I've got my iPhone 7 here. This thing is like, I don't know, 8 years old. So this phone would be able to use your app?
So not yet. There's several more steps to take. We're kind of in the middle of the process. We validated the concept on one specific Android phone.
Mm-hmm.
And we, you know, in future studies want to validate that maybe certain iPhones work.
But I would put my finger over the camera or hold it at a distance from the camera, or how would that work?
Yeah, if we were to validate the app on your phone, you would put your finger over the camera and the flash.
And the flash.
And the flash shines through your finger.
And it's bright enough to actually illuminate, like go penetrate the skin so the camera can pick up certain range of colored light? Is that how it works?
Exactly. Yeah. Your camera always gathers in the red, green, and blue wavelengths. That's right. How it kind of forms a picture. Those different wavelengths, actually at the different wavelengths, light is absorbed differently in different types of tissue. That's kind of the physical basis for what we're doing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, once the light shines through and your camera's picking up different ratios of red to green to blue.
So it's the ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you used artificial intelligence to compare what the phone was picking up compared to the known oxygenation levels of the people testing it. And the thing just learned from that, huh?
Pretty much. I think the artificial intelligence portion, or the machine learning, is useful to sort through some of the noise that's inherent in a smartphone camera. Purpose-built pulse oximeters don't need artificial intelligence. They use more of a statistical method called the ratio of ratios method, because they're specifically designed to gather at precise wavelengths. Because the camera is kind of designed for photography and not designed for health sensing, we need kind of a machine learning approach that will sort through some of the extra noise that comes into the sensor.
But that's a big deal that you don't have to modify the phone in any way to get this to work. So I know this is early. You haven't finished this one yet, but you have other ideas cooking around that include detecting other medical problems?
Yeah, definitely. My lab has been, you know, Shwetik Patel is my advisor, has been working on these problems for a decade at least now. So we've kicked around all sorts of different ideas, between like hemoglobin to SpO2 to, you know, heart rate and variability within different areas of the body, like when your blood arrives at various different locations.
What about diabetes?
That's a tough one. That's always the question that people ask, though.
Oh,
because
really?
it's extremely valuable for people who experience diabetes to be able to monitor their blood sugar all the time
without having to poke their finger.
Yeah. And if we could get there, that'd be awesome. I mean, big companies like Google and AI companies are working on it. There is actually one paper that one of my lab mates is working on, not necessarily an unmodified smartphone, but, you know, we're kicking around ideas that could potentially make it more accessible.
UW doctoral student Jason Hoffman. Jason, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.